Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 23, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear a litigation update on the case In re Walgreen Stockholder. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Ted Frank, Senior Attorney and a Director of the Center for Class Action Fairness at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I will turn it over to Ted to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Ted. The floor is yours.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for being here. Walgreens Stockholder was the first federal case dealing with, or first federal appellate case dealing with, the issue of standards for approving settlements in M&A shareholder litigation. Deal litigation, which are shareholder actions challenging public company mergers, is increasingly common. It was up to 93% of deals over $100 million. In 2012, and then over 97.5% of deals in 2013. And the reason for this is not so much that every single board member in civilization is breaching their fiduciary duty, or that the very expensive law firms devising disclosures are not doing their job properly, but because by engaging in this litigation and threatening an injunction that would be, one, expensive to defend, and even more expensive if a district court gets it wrong and agrees to delay or enjoin the merger, creates tremendous settlement pressure by the defendants. And it's always possible, given the large stakes of the litigation, for the lawyers who bring these suits to offer a settlement that is cheaper for the defendant than continuing to litigate. And these settlements are most often structured in such a way that the class of putatively injured shareholders receives nothing. The lawyers receive a sum in the high six to low seven digits, and the class receives some supplemental disclosures relating to the merger. And those supplemental disclosures are interesting because if you look at them, they're almost invariably quite trivial. We had a disclosure in the Walgreen case where they claimed it was a benefit to shareholders to learn that when they hired a new CEO, they were looking at his experience and other factors. And that supplemental disclosure was said to justify both the settlement and the large several hundred dollar an hour attorney's fees as a benefit to the shareholders. Mark Twain had a saying that everybody complains about the weather and nobody does anything about it, and there's certainly a lot of complaints about this sort of deal litigation, which was recognized as essentially a tax on mergers and a wealth transfer from shareholders to the lawyers who were bringing these suits. And unlike in the Mark Twain scenario, two activists decided to do something about it. One was Fordham Law Professor Sean Griffith, and the other was my organization now at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Center for Class Action Fairness. And on behalf of shareholders who were putatively benefited by these settlements, we started challenging these $0 disclosure-only settlements. Sean got the first success in this area by getting Delaware courts to issue a statement in a case called In re Trulia, stockholder litigation, holding that, yes, these settlements are problematic. This type of litigation to benefit the lawyers and not the shareholders is problematic. And in the future, the Delaware courts are going to say, we're not going to sign off on these settlements where the release is broader than the underlying litigation, or where the supplemental disclosures fail to be clearly material. And by clearly material, we, the Delaware courts, mean that there's just no question that they added something material to the mix of information that shareholders were perceiving in evaluating the merger. And in most of these litigations, of course, the supplemental disclosures had really no effect on the shareholder votes, and the settlements were being approved by 90 to 98% margins, or even more. While Delaware was making up its mind on these things, we challenged a case in the Northern District of Illinois involving the merger of Walgreen Company and Boots, a British pharmaceutical chain. A shareholder brought suit, claiming various injuries and breaches of fiduciary duty, and settled for a waiver of all of this, all the alleged lack of disclosure, in exchange for what were really trivial, immaterial supplemental disclosures. We challenged this as an inappropriate settlement that benefits the lawyers at the expense of the putative clients that they're representing in the putative class. The district court, operating under previous precedents by other district courts, resolving how to handle this, usually on an ex parte basis without objectors, said it was recognized that the disclosures were not especially meaningful, but that it was enough to approve the settlement. And we took that up to the Seventh Circuit. And while that was pending, truly it was decided, which helped, certainly helped our case to the Seventh Circuit, that because we had a specific precedent we could point to from the Delaware courts, and could ask the Seventh Circuit to simply adopt that rule rather than create a new rule out of whole cloth about how to handle this sort of extortion that hurts the class members that it's supposed to be helping. We got an interesting panel of Posner, Sykes, and District Court Judge Yandel from the Southern District of Illinois, and in a very feisty argument in June, resulted in an August decision whereby a 2-1 vote and an opinion written by Judge Posner. Judge Posner criticized this type of litigation as a racket and said this is something that district courts need to stop. These particular disclosures were not material, much less clearly material, and the Seventh Circuit hereby adopts the Trulia standard that Delaware had used. Excuse me. That it was interesting because the opinion was issued without a dissenting opinion, other than to remark that Judge Yanda would be issuing a dissenting opinion eventually, and that was in August, and that hasn't happened yet. I hadn't seen that particular scenario in an appellate decision, but sure enough, the Seventh Circuit actually has a specific rule for what to do when a dissenting judge fails to come up with a dissenting opinion within, I think it's 42 days, and that must be what happened there, and the Seventh Circuit just simply went ahead and issued the opinion without waiting for the dissenting opinion, which still hasn't come. In the wake of Trulia and now Walgreen, the number of deal litigation suits has declined. In particular, they've moved out of Delaware and largely into federal courts, though whether they'll continue to move into federal courts post-Walgreen is an interesting question, and I haven't seen what's happening with that in 2017. They're also moving into state courts, and we've seen these being brought in California and New York and New Jersey and Illinois state courts, and there's an interesting game of whack-a-mole going where we're asking courts in various jurisdictions to adopt the Trulia standard. In the first one of these appellate cases to come up outside of Delaware in the Seventh Circuit, Gordon versus Verizon, an interesting case where the trial court actually rejected the settlement on the sort of grounds that Professor Griffith has raised and we've raised, that this wasn't actually benefiting shareholders and the settlement benefits were too light to justify the release. In a case called Gordon v. Verizon earlier this month, between the time we scheduled this teleform and today, the New York Appellate Division ruled that they would not adopt the Trulia standard, that the sort of peppercorn relief that justifies a settlement was perfectly appropriate, and it was perfectly appropriate to award the attorneys hundreds of thousands of dollars of shareholder fees for that peppercorn benefit, not least because the shareholders realized the additional benefit of ending the litigation, and which is always struck me as an interesting form of chutzpah to say that shareholders are benefiting by this class action settlement because it stops the harmful class action, the class action that was harming the shareholders that we brought. Sort of like the apocryphal tale of the man who kills his parents and then pleads for mercy from the court because he's an orphan. So that case has been decided by the appellate division. It probably needs to go back down to the lower court for a determination and final judgment before it could go up on further appeal, though the parties are certainly looking at whether there are appellate options earlier than that. We have a case pending in the state of California where the trial court rejected the Trulia standard, and we're taking that up to the appellate courts of the state courts of California. And we have a case in the Fifth Circuit where a pro se objector did come in and say, hey, there are these Trulia and Walgreen decisions that are out there, and the settlement fits directly within them, and you should decertify the class and throw out the case, as the Seventh Circuit argued in Walgreens. The district court refused to do that on the grounds that the Fifth Circuit had not yet adopted Walgreen as a standard. We've agreed to represent this objector on appeal and just completed briefing on that in the Fifth Circuit this week, and presumably oral argument will be scheduled later this spring or summer, or maybe even this fall. But it'll be interesting to see whether the Fifth Circuit chooses to create a circuit split with the Seventh Circuit. Obviously, these raise a couple of issues. In terms of the forum shopping that's going on, where the parties are starting to take these outside of Delaware courts, the question is whether corporations should try to protect themselves by creating forum selection clauses in their bylaws and various other corporate documents to require suits against the directors be brought in Delaware to avoid that sort of forum shopping. And would certainly protect shareholders from this sort of extortionate racket. One thing we heard in both Walgreen and in the Crestwood case in the Fifth Circuit by defendants who filed very short briefs arguing not so much that the supplemental disclosures were material or benefited the class, but they argued, we have to be able to pay this extortion, otherwise we'll be subjected to really expensive litigation. And if we can't settle it this way, shareholders will be made worse off. I think that's a very short-sighted view that confuses the ex-ante versus the ex-post incentives. if lawyers know that they can't bring these meritless suits and come up with meritless relief and get paid for doing it, they're not going to spitefully engage in millions of dollars of discovery just to lose a case. They need to make a living, and they're not going to bring the meritless case if it now becomes too expensive for a defendant to settle without these sorts of cheap payoffs. And we're already seeing that in the fact that it's no longer 97.5% of mergers that are being challenged, but a much lower percentage, and certainly not in Delaware. And in the Walgreen case itself, rather than argue that the case needed to be continued and that class counsel needed to be there to protect the shareholders' interests, they slunk away and dismissed the case without taking a penny from the shareholders, and ultimately saving the shareholders quite a bit of money, I think. And I think that will be the right result, and we've seen this in other situations where we've knocked out the $0 settlement that was brought, that was achieved to settle a frivolous case. And it's really important to recognize that these cases are frivolous, that when these supplemental disclosures are being issued, what we're seeing is not disclosures that would ever be the sort of disclosures that could survive a 12b6 motion. If you made the allegation that the defendant had failed to disclose these facts that were eventually realized in the supplemental disclosure, these would be lawsuits that would be laughed out of court by the triviality of what's being supplemented. I look forward to your questions. These are, I think, are very interesting cases, and we look forward to continuing bringing them, and we're always looking for clients in this area. I think the greatest problem we have is timely notice. Often what we're hearing, we often don't hear from class members until after the objection deadline, in part because I think there's a systematic problem where parties are agreeing to notice structures that ensure that individual shareholders don't receive timely notice. But where we can receive timely notice and where we can get a class member, we'd love to be challenging many more of these abusive settlements and hopefully eliminate the number of jurisdictions that permit this sort of thing entirely. I look forward to your questions.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Let's go to our first question. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Ted. This is Lenore. I have a quick question for you. How much does it cost a typical medium-sized law firm to bring the sort of case you are describing?
Well, I mean, I think that's interesting because I think it costs them very little. It's just a question of drafting the complaint with fairly boilerplate allegations and then putting in the few dozen hours necessary to threaten a TRO or preliminary injunction. And they can avoid actually putting in real time until it's the defendant makes clear that they're going to settle. And so it's really a very small investment with all of the hours being put in after all the risk has gone away. The defendant has made clear they're going to settle. Then they'll do something called confirmatory discovery where they shuffle some papers around and review some documents and maybe take a few depositions for the sake of taking a few depositions. So, you know, while sometimes these firms are claiming, oh, we're not even getting our lodestar in there, the lodestar was often generated after the case was clearly meant to settle. And very often it is a multiplier of Lodestar. So, I mean, this really is a racket. It really is a very profitable line. And, you know, it's only a problem if too many law firms jump in at once and you have to divide up the pie, because once you demand an amount over a certain amount of fees, then the economics change, and it's probably worthwhile for the defendant to actually defend these things.
I see. Thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for Friday, February 24th at 3 p.m. That call will feature two experts who will discuss the Congressional Review Act's rediscovery and its hidden uses. The call will feature the Honorable David M. McIntosh, President of the Club for Growth and Vice Chairman of the Federalist Society, and Todd F. Gaziano, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Law and Executive Director of the Pacific Legal Foundation's D.C. Center. Now we'll go to our next question. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, Ted, it's Sean Griffith.
Hey there.
Great presentation. I just wanted to sort of chime in on two points, and I agree with everything that Ted has said. One is, where are these cases going when they leave Delaware? So at the same time that Delaware got a little bit tougher on these disclosure-only settlements, Delaware said, you know, companies can adopt exclusive forum provisions to bring this sort of litigation back to Delaware. So if you put those two things together, Delaware's got a tough standard for dealing with these settlements, and defendants can opt into Delaware through a forum selection provision. And so we've seen sort of two things. Number one, companies aren't exercising or adopting forum selection provisions to bring the litigation back into Delaware, probably because of what Ted said in the call, which is that defense counsel have adopted the short-sighted view that the only way to get rid of the holdup problem is to pay the holdup. And so that's problem number one. But problem number two is that forum selection clauses can't get cases out of federal court. And the way that the cases get into federal court is on a 14A9 sort of fraud in the proxy theory, which is the exact parallel of the state law fiduciary duty claim about disclosure. So if the plaintiffs bring it as a federal 14A9 case from the get-go, which I think Walgreen was, Ted, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, then the forum selection clause can't reach them, and it doesn't. It's not a Delaware issue at all. It's a federal district court issue, which, as everyone knows, are uncoordinated and don't have a very good way of solving the problem. So I think the issue is, if the federal courts don't follow Trulia throughout the system, there's sort of always going to be this runaround of whatever states do, putting aside whatever dispute there might be between Delaware and New York on this particular issue.
And that's correct. And I think the Fifth Circuit case will be very important on this, because if they stand with Walgreen, we'll now have two appellate courts standing in unison that truly applies to these sorts of 14A9 settlements. And you know, we might there will be other cases that peter into federal court, and as I mentioned, the number of 14A9 cases has dramatically increased in 2016 as people fled there to avoid Trulia. But it's going to be harder and harder for district courts to say, well, my circuit hasn't adopted Trulia, when every other circuit to consider the question has. Again, part of the problem are these ex parte presentations where, you know, district courts are not are designed to handle adversarial proceedings. And if they only hear one side of the story, I mean, what happened in the Crestwood fairness hearing, class counsel essentially lied to the court and said, oh, Walgreen is only a case about attorney's fees. It has nothing to do with class certification or settlement approval. And you should follow the Fifth Circuit on attorney's fees. You know, I have no idea whether the district court took that at face value or double-checked it, but the district court's inclinations are always going to be, let me get this off of my docket, without more and more firm appellate decisions, we could have that problem. Of course, if Crestwood goes the other way and actually reaches the merits and actually affirmatively refuses to adopt Walgreen, we'll have a clean circuit split. We could take to the Supreme Court, and I think the Supreme Court will stand with shareholders over lawyers, with or without Gorsuch on the court. But again, to do this, we can't just be officious in the meddlers. We need shareholders who are adversely affected by these things. So, you know, take a look at your portfolios, and if you hold shares in any stocks that that are recently the subject of merger announcements, and this is you agree with us that this is a problem, we'd love to hear from you, and we can discuss what your legal options are if a lawsuit is brought over your stock and somebody's trying to extract money from shareholders to go to lawyers.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforums. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any more questions.
I was really persuasive.
Would you like to make any closing remarks?
I think I just did, I thank everybody for attending and look forward to hearing from input from people and who'd like to help me and Sean in this cause.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.